Welcome to Smaller Narratives for a Larger World, brought to you by IASH, Binghamton University's Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities. I'm your host, Cole DePew, and today we're talking to Akua Leslie Hope about the human myth. Akua is an incredible artist, activist, and human being who I've been lucky enough to work with in the Binghamton Poetry Project and to call a friend. This episode starts with her reading her poem, Encompass, and our awesome conversation follows. So, without further ado, here's our show.
Encompass. Sunshine is frequently crooked, and windows have certainties. Fireflies make cold light on warm evenings. I let go of designations that end futures. The next epoch will be kinder. I am a spaceship dreaming of landing on Mars, conveying the hopeful. I was a woman without heels who could only roll swiftly downhill. Inclines require assistance, power, or knowledge. Curb cuts are too steep. Strength is best bent. Sentience is not a gift when you are stuffed in a box, braying and crying for a red release or green expanse. I track dust and mud prints on shiny floors and yearn for a wise trajectory. Travesties are too soon forgotten. Clouds obscure as does fog, but weather is local until it's not. Finitude can comfort or constrain. This too shall pass. Scarcity is a falsehood of imprisonments. Skid marks are signs of consumption. Shred, repurposed, dispossessed. This is how I'm made useful. Encompass.
All right, Akua, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited.
Delighted to be here to talk with you, Cole, and thank you for the invitation.
You were one of the first people I thought of. Yeah, poet in the Binghamton Poetry Project, and this summer when we did the final reading. It was a small group.
The Binghamton Poetry Project is fabulous, seminal. It was wonderful for me. It got my juices flowing. I created work that I treasure and value, and also the whole idea of community. In this era, we're in this incredibly strange, challenging era where things are getting lost and things are getting found. And this new way of creating community, I could not have participated in the community otherwise. And I will say this at the beginning, that I'm speaking to you from the ancestral land of the Onondaga, also known as the Seneca, keepers of the Western Door, in the area currently called the Southern Finger Lakes region of New York State, in a tiny town that considers itself a city called Corning. I pay homage to the Seneca, past, present, and future, as I do to my own ancestors, by whose grace I exist and am sustained. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. Could I ask you why it's important for you to say that?
I'm going to try and make the long story short. A year ago, I participated in the World Science Fiction Conference called Con Zealand, and everyone in New Zealand, this brings tears to my eyes, everyone in New Zealand began all of their talks with land acknowledgement. I'd never heard it before. And it struck me to the core that I didn't know. So having lived in this area now for decades, I always took note that there were place names. The street that borders me is called Cohocton. The river that flows through where I live is called Chemung. And so I embarked on an expedition to find out whose land did I sit on. And that's how it began. But it began with Con Zeelin, which changed my life.
Can you share a little bit more about that experience? What is Con Zeelin and why were you there?
Okay. Con Zeelin was the World Science Fiction Convention held in New Zealand. And New Zealand, in this time of pandemic, is one of the rare areas of Earth that did not suffer the pandemic in the way the rest of us have. They did not have this huge loss of life. They acted and moved swiftly. The convention there was equally informed and conducted totally virtually, though they had planned to have people fly from all over the world to New Zealand. They didn't. And it went, since they are in another time zone, for me, it was about not sleeping for like a week. It was day and night. It was mind-boggling to me. I've never been to a convention. Again, one of the strange benefits of this time of not being able to be together, finding other ways to create community. So I got to participate. I won a scholarship to go there, or you know, a grant to attend, because I couldn't afford the fees. And that was one kindness that just blew my mind. And so much of what has happened to me in this last year is a result of having attended that conference. I started my own Speculative Sundays poetry reading series, where I have the current creators of speculative poetry read their work and interview them. That's been one amazement that's come from Con Zeelin, because I was inspired to mimic what they do and what you do and try to create a platform and create community and share the work and also serve verse. How can I, as a creator, also be a cultural worker? And I grew up with that kind of language in New York City. And this new technology offers these incredible tools. So while, you know, on television I hear people make fun of Zoom fatigue, that can be a real thing. It's opened up the ability to talk to people across time and space. And talking with people in New Zealand, I'm talking to people who are in the future and I'm in the past.
Yeah.
Right? When we're talking simultaneously across time zones, when did that ever exist before? We're living and taking for granted this technological bounty. And some of us, like you, and the Binghamton Poetry Project, are using it for good. And I want to do that too.
It is a bit of a superpower, I think. I send someone an email and I can get them face to face with me. And it's so convenient. One thing I love is just not having to travel anymore to connect
Absolutely.
With these people.
Yes.
Yeah. It's been really, you know, and I do identify with Zoom fatigue for sure. Especially teaching, when all the students are browsing the internet on Twitter, and you can see it, you know, in their eyes. But I also, you know, I feel for them. You mentioned the future and speculative poetry. I just want to to bring up a quote from your website. You call speculative poetry the poetry of possibilities.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that definition a little bit?
Oh, that's so. I work so hard to make it succinct. And I like the alliteration. Poetry that engages other views of reality. Now, maybe all poetry does, and all poetry does, but I'm saying not solely as metaphor, but as fact. Isn't it? So it sounds contradictory to make fact fiction, but isn't the best fiction is the truth? So how do you delve in a truth in a way that helps you review, reshape, interrogate reality truly, deeply, thoroughly? And the Kraken in the poem could stand for the oppressive overlords of our current system. And the Kraken could indeed just be a monster of the psyche. And the Kraken could be imaginary. I don't know why the Kraken came to mind, but the
Kraken. I love the Kraken. This is an octopus.
But right? I love the Kraken. I was going to say,
I love the Kraken out of the Kraken.
So that's not more definitional. It's more descriptive.
Yeah, I think even just the way I phrased that, like asking you to define it is not a really helpful way to go about it either. I think maybe...
Oh, don't chastise yourself.
No, yeah.
You're an academic. That's what they do.
I know. I try to control these narratives and use words to make sense of other words, and I get myself in trouble that way. Yeah. So what energizes you? What brings you to write about this future, this fact? Why are you so excited about speculative fiction or speculative poetry?
It was put in me like a dream, you know, what's the expression? God put a dream like steel in my soul. My parents put the speculative and science fiction like steel in my soul. It's part of the weft and warp of my life since I was created. And okay, so I'll say just a teeny bit about my background. All four of my grandparents migrated here from the Caribbean, from two islands, on my father's side, Montserrat, on my mother's side, Jamaica. So these are people who were dreamers and voyagers using the technology of transport of their era, these ships. And they all landed in New York City. They didn't know each other beforehand. They met and married in New York City. My parents grew up within four blocks of each other in an area that's also been made mythic called Harlem in New York City. And there was profound creative energy. That wasn't my energy. That's the energy they put into me. My grandparents put it into me. They were dreamers and thinkers and talkers, far, far more eloquent than I am. I try hard. I still feel I'm that little child toddling to keep up behind them, running behind them, expressing and trying to share what they shared with me. So, and to bring it down to earth, if other people are from my era, I saw the Twilight Zone, and that was always an object of discussion. We saw The Outer Limits, the first, and that was always an object of discussion. And I watched Star Trek, the original Star Trek, in black and white. And the whole family would be piled on the couch. Poor parents passing out. Both my parents worked. My mother always fell asleep. We would be jostling her. Did you see that? Did you see that? And she'd be like, oh, yeah. That was so good. Right? Back to sleep. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, from the beginning, one of my first best presents that I remember that wasn't a toy was the subscription to Analog magazine that my father, it was like, I was just like, you get me. But then I was like, okay, at that era, it was you get me. Later on, it was like, you made me, you know? So you get me, you made me, you get me, you made me, you made me, you get me. That subscription to Analog when I was 12 was just, it was like gold to me. And every month, a treasury that was mine. So that's some of the beginnings.
Let me read a stanza that you shared on your website that you think I think you said it was one of the first speculative poems you've ever written. And I'm going to read it for you. I guess.
Thank you. Well,
you wrote it. but I'm just very, because you're talking about your childhood, and I think it's so cool that you say you were born with it, because a lot of my passions, I feel like I've uncovered as if they were there always. But I don't really, I have a lineage with writing in my family. My grandmother, who was a writer, she loved to write. She loved poetry, but her parents,
fabulous.
Her dad never let her go to college or, you know, become a writer.
Oh.
She was a nurse. And we have a really nice bond because of that. And I owe her some poems, actually. But yes.
That's beautiful that you owe her poems.
Yeah. Well, I talked to her, on Tuesdays, and, she asked me if I had finished a certain poem about an old buddy of mine.
And how exquisite.
I know. She has a lost art of being able, she memorized so many poems.
And does she read them to you and say them
to
you?
Yeah, she sings them. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were shaped by the oral too.
Yeah, yeah, I must have.
And been. Verse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Poetry was something I was afraid to pursue.
Why?
Well, I mean, it comes out of insecurity, I think. But there's this kind of.
You're so young. What did that to you? I don't know. I have this weird idea that younger folks did not have to go through any of the crap that I did. That we cleared the path for you. That you would know it was okay to be a, you know, like those stories. Oh, the boy couldn't do ballet dancing. I mean, I thought all of that stuff was out of the way, Cole. Oh,
yeah.
You're breaking my heart.
Well, a lot of it comes from the economic pressures.
Yes.
So when I was studying English in my undergrad, someone would ask me, what are you studying? English. Oh, you're going to be a teacher. And I didn't really necessarily want to be a teacher. And I always took that as a bit of a dig. And that's my own, you know, issues, I guess, my own ambition. But I would lie, you know, I would say no. Or sometimes I would want to lie and say, oh, I'm doing marketing or finance or something, you know? These really strange pressures to make money.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. See, I thought, you know, I have an MBA in marketing.
Oh, cool.
I have two grad degrees, and for what you're saying, I live that. So it sort of breaks my heart to also hear that.
Yeah, the same stories happen over and over again.
I thought, see, I'm like your grandma's age, right? I thought I thought we had broken the cycle. I had thought we had made it okay to not have to go and do anything other than your art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
each generation still has, is still that you're saying this it's breaking my heart to hear you're so many generations later. Why did you have to suffer that?
I have no idea. You know, what's what guys do, I guess, supposed to go to finance. Guys like me, at least. All my friends, business majors, marketing majors, advertising, all of that.
Yeah, I did all of that.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I know. It's kind of sad. I mean, listen.
It is sad.
I went into sales. That's what I did. You know, I went into corporate sales.
That's the worst. Oh my gosh.
It's part of my story, though.
I'm sorry. Sorry, salesman. Don't mean to say that, but.
Yeah, no, I mean, sales is awesome if you like it, for sure. And it is a form of storytelling and persuasion. And I do a
well,
lot
death
of
a salesman taught us.
Yeah, no one goes to your funeral. I don't know what he sold, Arthur something.
Right.
Poor guy.
And what was the other one that's not Death of a Salesman, but more brutal? The movie.
Pursuit of Happiness. That one was good.
Was it Glengarry?
Yeah. Glengarry, Glenn something. Or
Glenn
he has the
Ross,
watch. It's like
Glenn
this watch.
Ross.
Yeah. This watch is 10,000 or ABC. You know, my boss, while I worked on sales, he made us watch that movie.
Oh.
Yeah, it's the culture, yeah.
Oh, unironically, right?
Unironically made you. Inspirational, yeah.
Oh, no.
ABC,
oh,
always
gosh.
Be closing. I sold payroll software. And the main thing that stunk about it was when I did something good, it didn't give me a ton of pride or excitement. But when I did something bad, it was like the floor fell out from under me.
Cole, how did you escape? How did you throw off? Like, number one, I'm warning that you even fell into that. But I'm saying, having gone into the muck, how did you wash it away?
Well, I mean, it wasn't simply that. I was going through a lot of issues with addiction and drinking. So I ended up kind of bottoming out.
But that's part of that environment.
No.
Oh,
pretty bad.
My gosh.
So then I ended up going to a rehab, drug rehab.
And that helped
started
with
my life over. And I got a job at a coffee shop. And I
congratulations.
Took a community college creative writing class in New Haven, Connecticut. And here I am today, once, you know.
Beautiful.
One day.
That's some intense work.
Yeah, Cole. Yeah. Well, a lot of my writing at first was about that recovery. Now I've changed. I've started to write about the environment and humanity and the animal.
I know, but recovery is a lifelong journey, right?
Of course.
So
yeah.
you can, and there are many, 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 many people, as you, if you don't know, I'm telling you, who still need that help and assistance and insight.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. So that's how I got out of sales.
Oh my gosh. It's like you had to pay a pound of flesh to get away from it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But here we are.
I'm glad.
Let me read your stanza.
I'm glad you did.
Thank you. I know.
I'm glad you did to co-chair the Binghamton Poetry Project. Yeah.
Quite the roundabout to get to that position.
Oh my gosh.
So here we go. All right.
I mean, do you ever feel pressed for lost time?
At first I did, yeah. But now I'm very grateful for those experiences. I would be half of the man I am today if I had never experienced that pain. I just didn't, you know, I wouldn't have got, you know, what matters. And
so it was your rite of passage.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great way to look at it. Yeah. Yeah. I think.
Well, because our culture does not have the rites of passage. Most of our indigenous previous or informing cultures do or did, right? What makes an adult in our culture?
College.
Is it 4 years of college?
Right.
I was just going to say, is it 4 years of college?
It almost feels like the bar of adulthood has been keeps pushing later and later in people's lives. I mean,
exactly.
It's a generalization.
No, but it does. It does for some.
Right. Yeah,
But I challenge that both you and I came up with college as the metric.
Mm-hmm.
There are those for whom college is never in their purview. So what is their rite of passage? High school? But no, because then popular culture does not recognize the high school graduate as an adult. it's the high school graduate is the high school graduate. It might as well be the junior high school graduate, or right?
Getting your driver's license. I was thinking maybe the death of a parent or being a parent. I feel like those are two.
Sadly, if popular culture doesn't make being a parent an adult either.
Right.
I mean, MTV.
Oh, I know Teen Mom.
All those Teen Mom shows, right?
Mm-hmm. True.
Right. They're living at home with the baby, still fighting with their parents, fighting to make parenting decisions with their parents. I mean, anyway, you may get to cut this out because maybe we're digressing.
No, this is so important. Like it, and I'm not going to say defining, but understanding what adulthood means is at the same time thinking about what childhood means. And I know that mm-hmm. the definition of childhood changes so much. I mean, the idea of childhood in general is relatively new, probably a couple hundred years old.
Well, in Western culture, because right. again, if we think of original cultures, originating cultures, the same folks who defined adulthood did define childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow you need both, right? So we got better at defining childhood, still not for all. Did I not see the most shocking, tear-inducing piece about children of farm hands and field workers today, current, you know, 2021, who are still negotiating, am I going to work in the fields or am I going to get to go to school?
Mm-hmm.
Will I be able to attend school? Am I not beside my parent who doesn't have daycare, you know, picking grapes or tomatoes or cotton or lettuce in the field? That's today. You know, and the story was about one young woman's struggle who wanted to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And how her brothers were, you know, their teenagers working in someone's farm fields.
A long time ago, people really couldn't have a lot of kids because kids were a bit of a liability, at least in the hunter-gatherer area. But then with agriculture, having
you
more
want
kids.
Them. You want the workforce.
Yeah, with agriculture, you need more and more. And then that's more mouths to feed. And it's like this cyclical positive feedback loop. And now people are having less kids now, at least in America, like you said, or Western culture. Or there's even a correlation between the more money someone makes, the less kids they're having today.
Okay, so on one level, it makes sense because is it money or is it education? Is it about understanding that the world has, as we've created it, to experience it? So I have to put all these caveats around it because I'm also kind of anti the idea of scarcity, but there's also the idea of overpopulation, right? How much is that or is that not a myth? You know, I remember overpopulation being discussed when I was a preteen. It was a big thing, you know, overpopulation, we're over. What part of that is over? And it's about the resources to feed and support. So, okay. So maybe those with money are also better educated and say, we envision a this, you know, whatever for our progeny. Therefore, we're not going to have a lot of progeny because each one will get more of whatever mm-hmm. this is. I mean, there's that aspect. Right, this materialism, right? There's that aspect to it. I could never prescribe for someone what the ideal family size would be.
The overpopulation, yeah. So I think there's almost 8 billion people now. The issue is really consumerism. It's about how much each of us are consuming, how many materials, you know, we collect, how much we eat, travel, that kind of thing. That's putting a strain on the natural resources around us.
That's one part of it.
Yeah.
One part of it is how much we consume. It's more, to my mind, how we consume.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'll say this
yeah.
about myself. when I went to college, I went to college with the idea that I was gonna, that it was going to be transformative, and it wasn't in the ways that I had hoped it would be. I went to a school that's considered the number one school in America and probably therefore the number one undergraduate school in the world, called Williams College. Mm-hmm. The year when I went, I was in the first class of women to go there. And what happened to me my first year is that I became a non-meat eater. Mm-hmm. And so I have not eaten meat for over 50 years. This is now what they are saying the world should do to make the world better. And I was thinking about the world when I made that decision at 18 to never consume a land creature ever again. And I never did. My mother joked, one day you'll call me and you'll say, guess what? I had a hamburger. And I used to laugh and think, no, I will never call you and say I had a hamburger. The only thing I've ever yearned for in the 50 years is a hot pastrami on rye with coleslaw from Katz's Deli in New York City, because that's where I'm from. Not a hamburger. I've never eaten McDonald's. I don't know what that's. I know what it's about because, of course, I live in this world, but I've never had any tacos, fried food, all of these. I've never indulged in any of those things. That's part of a way of being in the world. It's, yes, I'm still in the West. I have still flown on airplanes since I was 12 years old, fortunately. I've still used all of those things. I spent years trying hard to think of a way to put solar on the roof of my house. Mm-hmm. I'm just using me to say it's not just consuming, it's how you consume. It's how you consume and what you consume. You know, do you use gray water? Do you recycle your water to feed your garden? There are all these things that people have discovered and understand that can sustain us in a way that we've become accustomed to, just not as, you know, avariciously or as thoughtlessly. Mm-hmm. Why are we still polluting waterways? This is shocking to me. There's no need for that. There is no reason. We have all the technologies to clean ourselves up immediately. And as you and I are talking, isn't this about the time they're having the climate conference? Yep. In this very moment? And so, and the UN came out and said something like, we need to cut everything by 55%, our emissions by 55% immediately, that we can no longer avert disaster, we can no longer avert disaster, we can no longer avert, but we can mediate it. Mm-hmm. We can mediate it immediately. So yeah, it took us, what, too long to figure out we could use better light bulbs. No one said live in the dark, right? We finally figured out there are better light bulbs. One of the things I used to love to say to people is I'd seen, thank you, PBS. Thank you, PBS. Thank you, PBS. As much as you annoy me, you've educated me enormously. I saw a show, this is dozens of years ago now. It was about lighting a village in Africa. They lit this village in Africa, of course, because Africa is always used as that kind of example, but it could have been in China because it was Chinese tech, where they built solar. But here's the thing that stuck in my mind. For $2,000, for $2,000, a village could be lit. But for my house to have solar would cost me $40,000 to $50,000. Now, why does it cost me? Why would it cost me, a poor poet, $40,000 to $50,000 to install a solar system to sustain me, but it only cost $2,000, which I could certainly afford and figure out how to pay, $2,000 to light a village of people in Africa? Those are the questions I know they're not going to engage in at the climate summit, but those are the questions that I, as a citizen on the ground, see and know are real. We could change. So the change can be made now. It could be made now, but there's not the unified will to make it. I'm thinking that I worked on and asked questions and, you know, I did the research. And so the batteries would cost me X amount of money and the labor would cost me Y amount. Like I said, the best estimate was like 40 to 50 grand to do it right, to sustain my household of a human and a cat. But somehow, but the tech does exist for a whole village of humans and livestock to be lit and fueled and have clean water for $2,000.
Well, I would suppose that some of that would have to do with just the economies in Africa and how far $2,000 can go there. But I do understand what you mean, the scalability of these technologies. I mean, we're so embedded in our lifestyle, we're so used to things, and the narrative around switching into a green lifestyle is usually framed as a sacrifice.
You're getting it. Thank you for framing it that way, because I'm saying, and that's a fallacy,
right?
And it's framed as a sacrifice to keep us from engaging it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a loss, and we hate loss. I mean, we want more and more and more. You spoke around this word, I think. Forget, you said you were anti-scarcity, I think.
Yes.
And I was thinking of the word abundance.
This is a land, I've written poems about abundance. There's lots. Okay. So let me talk about one of my other endeavors in terms of the whole idea of abundance. I'm a paper maker, a hand paper maker. I've been a hand paper maker now. I didn't realize, I mean, you know, time just passes. You do it and then time passes and then you see, oh my gosh. So I started papermaking in 1993, so this is a long time now. And I began papermaking because I said, as a poet, I use all of this paper. I should be recycling this paper. So I came at it initially from the idea of recycling. And to me, now, that's the worst stuff. The worst stuff is the stuff I recycle because it's already yucky stuff. It's already wood pulp, and I'm recycling wood pulp. Guess what? My yard has better fibers, better paper. I make better paper from the weeds driving down the road. Fabulous paper. Paper like you've, you want to write on it, you want to paint on it. You can do all of those things with the paper that I can make from weeds, that other paper makers would make from weeds. My goodness. Well, some developing nations have finally awakened to this, having minimal tree resources, and they're saying, oh my gosh, sugarcane waste makes great paper. Guess what? Why is there all of this clothing waste, right? Choking up the oceans, polluting Ghana. You know, I saw this story, but and I wanted to write someone and said, but for the lack of imagination, you could take those clothes out of that trash heap, grind them up, and make paper, make better paper than the paper from wood. Because guess what? What's the paper we all pay for? The paper we all pay for when we're doing something special is cotton or linen. It's renewable. And the cotton paper is, cotton linters are the waste of the process of making cloth. So, okay, so cotton cloth can be ground up again, but the linters, which people sell for tons of money of pound, but linters are lint. Suddenly I realized, I mean, it's the lint, it's the debris. The debris is better stuff than the, you know, I just did finger quotes in the ear, why are we killing trees? We've never needed to kill trees. We've never needed to kill trees. We've never needed to kill trees for a piece of paper. In fact, there's a poem where someone says, She loved someone so much she would even kill trees for them.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I so wanted to, no, don't think of who, because I'm going to go on and say, I so wanted to grab this person and shake him and say, you never needed to kill trees. And if you had just done one little Google search, you would have seen that, which undoes the whole poem, right? Because it's about this great love. I'm like, but you never needed to do that. You never needed to do that. I make art with my paper. My interest is more sculptural and not pages, because I'm not a drawing person. I love sculpture. And I know they won't get to see this, but here's one that's at hand.
Oh my God, that's made of paper.
That's made of paper.
It's so cool because it's a return to, it looks like a plant.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sort of is the leaf shape. And I won a grant this year for my, for a series called Now Voyager, where I'm making paper and using a vacuum table to shrink and distort the shape of paper. That the paper piece I just held up is made of kapok. Kapok is a tree seed here. It's long and it's beautiful. And I beat it so that it would shrink fast. So I get the shape, right? I made the shape because I asked the paper to make that shape.
Ooh.
And for those who didn't see it, it's like a leaf curled, a curled leaf shape. But big. If I flattened it out, it's, you know, a little like 18 inches long and about 6 inches wide. So to your point, I believe in abundance. We've stopped using our imagination. We can fulfill our wills, our desires, but healthfully. But we've never interrogated ourselves to say, yeah, I want that, but how do I do that in a healthful way? We've never included what I take to be the indigenous thought of what effect will fulfilling this desire have 7 generations later?
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean you don't fulfill the desire. It means you think of what the ramifications are of fulfilling it in a particular way. That's unbelievable, because I would say think like a tree.
Yeah.
And we now know that trees communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That trees live in community, that healthiest trees live in community, that what we see is not the tree. Right? What we see is an expression of the, you know, like most of life, what our eyes perceive is only the smallest spectrum of reality. Again, thank you, PBS. Did I realize that most of the world is flashing, signaling in colors that I cannot perceive? That under, we say it's, you know, under the sea, the dark sea. The sea's not dark. The sea's dark to us. We are the blind stumbling in the narrowest of spectrum in terms of sound and sight. And for some beings, like our mammal brethren, sound is sight. Sight is sound. Here for us, when that happens, you what's the word? Synesthesia? You know, like something's wrong with the person.
You smell something and you hear, like if you smell a rose, you hear a fire hydrant or fire alarm or something.
Okay. Well, because that's the wild connections we make. But for other entities, you know, for the fur folks we live with, smell is informational in ways that it's not for us.
Yeah, we're so visual. But I love what you were saying about the tree. So my access to reality is so blurred. Like you said, I see something and then that gets filtered through my eye, which changes it a little bit. And then it goes into my brain. which distorts it again, because now I'm seeing it through my brain, and then it's filtered through all my lived experiences.
Yes.
And my judgments, and also my language. You know, so if I lived in a different time or I spoke a different language, even that would change my reality. A tree. Oh, it's just a tree. A tree. What does that word mean to me? You know, it's a big plant. It's, you know, what my desk is made of right now. So I love that. And it reminds me of what you said earlier, which I wanted to bring up, which is speculative poetry as a way of trying to access a multitude of perspectives and subjectivity.
Yes.
Rather than just living in this human-centered viewpoint where, you know, one really sad way to think of trees, but a lot of people do, is as standing lumber. You know, like it has no intrinsic value.
Right. It's not that it's not a being.
Right.
That it's not a being that pre-existed the human before it, that pre-existed that human's whole family line. Mm-hmm. That pre-existed in some places, all we know of humanity, all we know of human history. But that's on the surface. And under the water, I don't know. I've written about whales. I learned that whales, untrammeled, you know, unmessed with, mm-hmm. Some whales live for hundreds of years. Some whales have existed. Who are on the planet now have existed from before whaling, that they've seen whales with scars from harpoons.
Oh my God, it's beautiful.
The ones who, you know, who have survived to pass on the knowledge, you know, avoid those things. Those things, they're killers. Those little things that are on those, I don't know, pieces of something on top of us, you may get the sense, you may sound them and see that they are beings, but they're not beings in the way we understand beings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you come to understand that the whale brain is, I forgot what it was, many, many, many multiples the size of ours.
Huge.
And they use it, The speculative opened me up to receiving that and saying, why am I always looking out there for the alien when the alien is right here with me and we don't value it?
Mm.
I love when Star Trek engaged that thought, but they didn't even go as deep as they could go. But really, and I had an argument with a friend, I said, well, you know, the aliens came to talk to the whales. They didn't come to talk to us. And when they found that there were no whales to talk to, they were about to undo us. And I always believe the other subtext was the whales were saying, they're stupid, don't kill them, about humans. That was what the whale was saying, that they had to go back in time to get a whale to talk to this cigar-shaped thing. And wasn't that wild too? That was prescient because, how do you say it? The Awumamama? Awumamama?
What is that?
The Awumamama is a cylindrical shaped body that people don't know what it was, and it's going through our solar system.
Oh, like a UFO.
I mean, okay. So now, folks, I'm switching from the science fiction. Okay, I was referencing, just to be clear, I was referencing the Star Trek movie where they went back in time to get a whale because this huge alien arrived looking to have a conversation with humpback whales, which we allowed to go extinct. Okay, we made humpback whales extinct, and there was no way that the Federation, even as it existed, could not converse with this object that came to have a conversation with a whale which no longer existed. Okay, so some of you who know, forgive me, but I want other people to be in on it if we decide to include this. And but I'm saying today, so now fact, okay, switch to science fact, an object resembling what was in that Star Trek movie. A long cigar-shaped object is passing through our solar system and has been identified. And they call it the, and I'm trying to say the word, it's Oumuamua. Okay, so it's given a Hawaiian name. And I think it's called, that stands for the one who journeys or the journeyer.
The whale of the sky.
Yes, sort of.
Yeah. I read a book called Beyond Words, I think. And it is about inter-animal, interspecies communication and how, you know, you can talk to your pet cat to a degree. You know, you understand each other. You understand when your cat says something. And a lot of other animals have really complicated linguistic relationships, such as whales, for one, elephants.
Yes. Elephants, my other favorite. Yes.
So, I mean, elephants, there's so many cool things they do, but they can use such a low tone that we can't hear them.
We can't hear. Yes.
They'll actually shake the ground and their feet. And
through their feet. Yes. Yeah. You know what? Yes. You know. Yes.
They can warn each other of storms, of dangers up to 6 miles away. They're talking to each other from grunt to feet.
Yes.
I mean, just so beautiful.
Exactly, Cole. Thank you. Yes.
And I mean, they're doing that and we're standing next to them and we don't appreciate that because it's not our experience. It's not our experience to be able to access that.
So that, again, so the speculative engages that mythic magic. That's reality.
Yeah.
Right? It's reality. But it's not a reality that we all apprehend. It's not a reality that we all engage. Mm-hmm. But the moment you say that, I mean, like my day is lit again forever because I'm reminded of what exists beyond the limitations of the vessel in which I exist. But somehow my mind can engage it and envision it. And words make that happen. And the words can inspire and heal and energize. That's what we do in serving verse, in creating verse.
So beautiful. So I'm finally going to read this stanza. There's no stopping me now. That was 45 minutes ago. Here we are. We'll run and find a sacred place where I will kiss your burnt off face. And you will touch my non-existent lips as the bomb continues to rip this doomed world.
Oh my gosh. I wrote that in the sixth
grade. I was going to say, I don't know how old you are, but that's pretty intense for sixth grade.
That was sixth grade.
Yeah.
That's when I started writing speculative poetry.
I will kiss your burnt off face and you will touch my non-existent lips. So beautiful, so tragic, so romantic. So dystopian.
Oh, well, I read Animal Farm in the fourth grade and 1984 in the fifth grade and the sixth grade was Brave New World. And I remember having to get permission to read each of those in that era and, Ancient of Days. Because like I said, I'm about your grandma's age. So I remember reading each of those and getting permission. And my father in particular, well, because he worked at night, so he was the day parent. So he did all of what people think of as the mom things, like the PTA things. Mm-hmm. And my mother worked during the days. So anyway, he was like, but of course, if you can read it, why wouldn't we, why wouldn't we let you read it? And now I'm old. I'm just like, oh, my parents were a little wild.
Yeah, those books are pretty scary.
Those books are, but it, for me, I didn't feel that fear. The fear or concern that comes out in the poem is more from another lived experience, the lived experience of being trained for the dropping of a nuclear bomb. And that's what we went through. New York City public school, we were trained to duck and cover, to go under our desks. We would have these drills where they taught us what to do. as if that would do anything.
I know,
isn't that insane?
Yeah.
You go under a little wooden desk and put your face down if the nuclear bomb came.
Yeah.
And the other layer of reality is that there would be these, I don't even hear them anymore, these sirens, okay? Mm. And the sirens were the drills, more than fire drills, right? There were these siren drills prepared for the bomb drills. That was the era when people were building bomb shelters in their backyards, nuclear bomb shelters. Mm-hmm. You know, in America, where blessedly, fortunately, no bombs had dropped. The war was not, you know, the World War was not fought on our soil, but it came close to us, as close as Pearl Harbor. And, you know, and then after we created the nuclear bomb, it became a thing. We paid psychically. And, you know, since I was a kid who paid attention to stuff, it entered my poetry.
It's almost like getting the fate you're prescribed and making something beautiful with it. But it's also this fantasy world too.
Yes.
Which is just so cool to be able to respond to a fantasy, even though the fantasy is awful, and then to reshape it. It's like how we change memories to kind of serve us today. Like
absolutely.
Someone passes and we tend to remember them fondly.
Sometimes if we're lucky.
Well, they don't mind, they're dead, but yeah,
right.
I have so much more. Well,
maybe they do. Okay, so I've got a whole bunch of, I have a whole bunch of folks who, friends who create in the paranormal and horror genres. That's not my piece of the speculative, but they do.
Yeah.
So, you know, they might argue that, oh, they do remember, you know, and they do hear.
Death is only the beginning.
Death is only the beginning.
Thank you all so much for listening. Episode 3 will be with the excellent anthropologist David Mixter. Until then, peace.